morning, counselors. It's Wednesday, the 14th of January, and this is our second county manager briefing to the council or to the board. In keeping with my intent for these meetings, I think it's great that we have a chance to improve transparency regarding county operations. And so in the interest of that transparency and involving the board and the public in our affairs, we have two agenda items today. First is the annual plan for the event center and the county fair. Now, in the past, we have typically briefed the board after the fact, and I thought it would be useful to review the plan in advance. They are doing innovative things out there, and I think John will share some of those new ideas with you this morning. I'd like to point out that John became the executive director out there in 2013, and he achieved a 19.3% increase in revenues his first year. And he achieved another increase in 2014. So we're very lucky to have John out there as our executive director. So with that introduction, I will turn the floor over to John.
I just want to second that motion. John, you're doing a great job out there. Just love your leadership and the team and the success that you're bringing to our fair. Isn't that Donna? Just, okay.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. One of the reasons I like to come down and brief you, as Mark said, obviously, is the information that you need for your governance. But I enjoy it because the news is always good when it comes from the event center. I don't come down here with problems for you. One of the deliverables in our contract to operate the event center for you is to provide you with an annual plan, which gives a very brief look back in how the year prior went, and then a look down the road of what we see coming up for the coming year. And so that's what I have for you today. Mark provided you, I guess, an advance copy, and I've got one for you there if you'd like to refer to it if you need to. I will tell you we had a very successful year in 2014. We had a record Clark County Fair. And for the first time in a long time, the event center bottom line at the end of the year was positive. The fair had a $532,000 profit. And as you know, that is a combination of good people, good plan, a great community, and a good event that I think folks look forward to and enjoy coming to every year. The bulk of that money, of course, is in the event center pot, if you will, to help offset costs of the event center itself, whether it's the exhibit hall, which is tracked separately because of its bond issues, and then the grounds in general. And then the combination of all those did result in an overall event center profit. So I'm pleased to present that to you as the positive news. There's two ways we look at things out there. In the fair, we tend to look at things very, very dollar and cents oriented. The fair, I think, is a little bit different than almost any event that you go to, in that 100% of your expenses are committed before your first dollar of income comes. Now, when that fair kicks off on the first Friday of August, all those $2.8 million of expenses are committed. They're not spent, but they're committed. And so you put the best plan together as you can, and then you execute that, and I think we've done that well. On the event side, it's a little bit different. You look more at how busy is the event center. We were able to increase our event days this year by 36 event days from a year ago, which is pretty significant. We had 254 event days. That was 36 more than the year before, so a little over a 15% increase just in the number of days. In the event center, event days equate to dollars because we rent the event center. So that was a positive cash flow there.
Hey, John. And for sorry to interrupt you. For those that are, we're recording this, we post on the grid, and we're going to include whatever documents they had there. Just for the sake of those citizens that want to be able to follow you, you don't have to go by this, but if you refer to anything that you have in your little handout here to help them navigate to know what page you're on or what point you're on, that would be help them to tune in.
Oh, okay. So they've all got a copy of this, or
they will on
the
grid.
On our grid.
Okay, great. All right. So basically the year in review, which is page 2 of the document that's called the 2015 annual plan, shows those dollar returns both for the fair, the exhibit hall, and the grounds, and then the event days. As you know, the non-exhibit hall, the grounds out there are old. The equestrian arena is old. There's a lot of things that probably, if it wasn't for the potential of a master plan, that we would be able to do to improve things, but not to the extent I think that we spend a lot of money on something that might not have a return. At the end of this year, when I took a look at the bottom line profit, my plan for 2015 then became how to take some of those dollars and improve my ability to generate more in the next year. And so I had a very successful meeting with Bob Stevens from the budget office here. And along that line, I just want to mention that, and I've told you before, I don't ever get a no when I come to Clark County. You folks have leaned forward to help me, whether it's facilities, budget, your own personal support of things we do out there, and I appreciate that so much. So I prepared a list of about 5 or 6 high-priority projects that I thought we really need to do. And they're big enough projects that you might not budget for them if you didn't feel that you were going to come up with those kind of revenues, or you're going to be budgeting a false revenue sense just to put the expense in there. I thought it was better to get to the end of the year, see what my performance was, and then approach the county on the ability to have budget authority against those. A number one priority is to increase the effectiveness of the sound system in the horse arena. I consistently get input from big horse shows that you can't understand what the announcers are saying, whether they're in the ring or in the announcer stand. I've got air handling issues down there. It's a hot building that was not really designed for air handling. My small animal barn kind of sits in a little bit of a wet spot on the fairgrounds, and I'd like to get that paved this year, which I've got bids out to do that. One of the drawbacks of my ability to rent the exhibit hall has been the lack of breakout rooms or areas for people to go beyond the meeting they're having, and so I've looked into buying some kind of high-end room divider type things that allow me to offer people large flat space, breakout areas, and things like that. The Wi-Fi, I know you and I have talked specifically about that. The Wi-Fi on the grounds is abysmal. We had the effort that you supported last year to upgrade the Wi-Fi within the exhibit hall. That happened. It was very successful. If you recall, it was a straight open Wi-Fi, and so during the fair, by 10:30 in the morning, you couldn't get on the Wi-Fi. There's so many smartphones now, people would walk in the building and their smartphone would hook onto the Wi-Fi. The system was old enough that it had a 24-hour lock on any IP address. So if you walked out of the building and you went home, for 24 hours that IP address is sitting there waiting for you to come back in the building. And so after our meeting, we put that into a three-phase Wi-Fi. We have got an open Wi-Fi for the public. We have a vendor Wi-Fi for vendors so they can process credit cards. And then the basic Clark County Wi-Fi system exists in there. I need that same capability all over the grounds so that I can upgrade my ticketing system. There's some pretty cosmic ticketing systems that allow you to track revenue very accurately, that give you data on your customers, when they came through the gate, what your flows are. But if you don't have the Wi-Fi to support that, you're literally batch processing things and it doesn't have the same effect. So with Mark's help, the county's come out and then we're taking a look at what will be the requirement to get that upgraded out there. So my biggies for 2015 are to try to bring the facility up in a reasonable way that doesn't fly in the face of why are you doing that if that's going to just be overdone in the master plan. So that's where we're headed. Yes. Oh, thank you. And bleachers. We're really limited on seating at our events out there. If you came to the fair last year and you saw the sea lion splash, an exceptionally popular exhibit, but people stood and stood and stood for a long time in the sun there. I need more ability to seat people, so I've got a bid out now for 6 sets of bleachers in sets of 2 that are easily moved. They can go in the building, they can come out of the building. They can improve the experience for the public, and that's a big thing. Once a facility gets a bad reputation for things like that, it's hard to overcome. And so, as you well know, if you're an amphitheater person, that within months of the amphitheater open, nobody wanted to go because the parking's so bad. And it's hard to change those kinds of things. So I want to stay ahead of the things that give the public a positive experience when they're on the grounds. Thank you for that reminder. Okay. As far as the fair, obviously we were up in attendance. We had a record year. The numbers are on page 3 of that report at the top, and we did go through that when we gave the fair report here. I couldn't be happier with what happened out there. You know, we have food and beverage over $1.7 million. That's $170,000 a day going through that food court. Our carnival revenue was $1.3 million. Our commercial vendors were really happy this year. They're a flat fee, so I don't get a good feel for what they individually did in their booths. But when I see other numbers that I can draw parallels from, I know they did very well. Our admission revenue. The admission revenue stayed kind of flat, and that's interesting. I think when the economy weakens, I actually see less buying in the advanced market. And I think that's a reflection of folks that are concerned about, do I want to buy these tickets in May or June? What if I don't go to the fair? What am I going to do with those tickets? What am I going to do with that money that I could have used it? And so if the economy weakens a little bit, my gate revenue actually goes up a little bit because they wait until they get to the fair to buy the ticket. And it's a $2 difference, and I understand the philosophy of it. You don't buy something 3 months ahead that you might not use. When the economy is great, people are out there buying things in advance. So it was an exceptional year. I have taken a philosophy out there that I want you to come to the fair knowing you're going to see something brand new this year. It's never been there before. Last year we had the sea lion splash. We've never had anything like that. I don't think Southwest Washington, Clark County, even the Portland area has had sea lions. This year the sea lions are coming back, and we're bringing a display in called Wild About Monkeys. And it is another educational rescue type display that travels around and teaches people about these animals, how they exist in the wild, why when they can't exist in the wild anymore we need to take care of them, and how we as a public interact with them. So I think it'll be something that's interesting. You always weigh that balance of this is an agricultural fair, but fairs are different to everybody. If I go to a Rotary meeting and I talk about the fair, you might say, oh, I love it. The food is great. You say, boy, the rides are super. My kids enjoy it. Oh, I have the animals. It's something different to everybody, so I need to make sure that I take care of that segment as we go down the road, and we're going to do that in 2015. And I am confident you're going to see numbers that are as impressive as this when we're talking about this next year. My entertainment, there's no substitute for a successful plan, and that is 5 solid days of motorsports on the last part of the fair. That's a formula that succeeded. I don't think I would even begin to try to alter that. First 5 days, as you know, are the grandstand concerts. And I'm sure you're aware that we've moved those back from the amphitheater into the grandstand. It's overwhelmingly been asked for by the public. The bottom line dollars are just evident that how our bottom line tracked when we were using the amphitheater compared to not was dramatic. And I sort of characterized it as those were concerts during the fair, not concerts at the fair. There's a physical separation there. The kinds of concerts you put on in the amphitheater have a price tag that would tell you to make money at that, I'm going to start competing with myself. You're going to come out with your family and decide, am I going to spend $60 a pop for concert tickets, or am I going to spend $60 and bring my family into the fair? And you might not do both. And I need to be sensitive to that, and I think we have, and it's a formula that's worked for us. As far as some of our strategies, we are going to continue to self-promote our 2 main in-house events, and that, of course, is the Washington State Horse Expo, which comes up in February, and then the Clark County Holiday Gift Fair. Those are both events that were developed by the Event Center. We're our own promoter. It's got some advantages to it. Of course, you've got all the risk to it also. But this year, the Holiday Gift Fair returned about a $40,000 profit compared to about $30,000 the year before. And the Horse Expo was $50,000 last year, and we're anticipating it at about $60,000 based on our vendor rentals and our programs that we're offering. So those will continue in 2015. Capital improvements on page 4, we talked about that earlier, some things that I'd like to do, and I'm going to do it with the profit from the 2014 operation as opposed to try to budget down the road and see if I've got enough to make it and then come down here and tell you I didn't quite make it this year. I won't do that. I think the key out there in many cases is marketing, and I'm of a generation where marketing meant you read something in the newspaper. Marketing has gone so far beyond that now that it literally almost changes daily, whether it's a Facebook marketing, an Instagram, now Pinterest or whatever. I happen to have a very aggressive marketing gentleman out there who does a...
That's an understatement.
He does not need a chair at his desk because I've never seen him sit down. But he's done a great job. We for years had a cash sponsorship goal of somewhere around $60,000. Matt consistently hits that at about $170,000. He's really good at what he does. He's savvy in the social media world. I don't know how many of you, when you've come back from Portland, look on the left side just before the last thing you see on I-5 before you cross the river and come into Vancouver is that big billboard there, which is the Event Center billboard. I bought that thing 2 years ago, and we advertise our year-round events on it. We rotate the fair advertisement through it. But after you pass Hooters on the right, if you will, and you look right there on the left, that big billboard there on the west side of I-5, that's mine. And we use that to attract people who are coming back on their commute, who are coming into Washington for any number of reasons, and that was Matt's idea. He's just got a lot of good innovative things. He bought the back of all of the buses that go across the river in the morning on a commute. So as people are driving on the commute and spending their time in traffic, you're driving along behind a bus and there's a picture of a big cow or a steer or whatever it is, and advertising the Clark County Fair. So he knows how to target it, he knows what he's doing, and he's great in the social media. One of the things we've looked at are the cross-marketing. Advertising dollars are very precious. When we go out for sponsorships now, if you're not there while they're developing their budget, you're either too late. We're finding more and more that sponsorship dollars are divided up. What used to be a relatively easy $10,000 sponsorship to get might be divided up by that company into $3,000 sponsorships, $10,000, $1,000. And so you start looking for the cross-marketing where we'll get the sponsorship, but we'll cross-market you also. Typically, people want in a sponsorship some logo recognition, some website, and there's always the tickets to the fair and the things that have got some tangible value, but the intangibles are more and more coming into play in how you market, and we're going to try to leverage that as much as we can this year. As far as the budget goes for the coming year, I've got it budgeted for a profit. I think you're aware that the state fair fund initially in the governor's budget was zeroed out when the budget was presented to the governor by the Office of Financial Management. In my role as the president of the Washington State Fairs Association, I've traveled to Olympia several times and met with them. I've met with the director of the Department of Agriculture, more in a WSFA hat than in a Clark County Fair hat, because I do represent all 66 fairs in Washington now. It's a significant issue. It doesn't affect this report, but just for your own use and background, and Mark has been working with the county's lobbyists so that when they're in Olympia, they can present the case also for us. But basically, the fair fund is a $4 million fund across the biennium. It used to be embedded in the parimutuel tax returns. When that industry started to falter, there was a recognition on the state's part that fairs need to have this support for their premium and awards payments. There's 66 fairs in the state of Washington that qualify for this fund. Many of them have 75% of their budget built on that fund. Wauquiacum County is a great example. Their entire budget for that fair is $44,000, and they get $33,000 of it from the fair fund every year. So there's a a big challenge there. There'll be fairs who will disappear if this fund goes away, so we'll be up there arguing for reinstating that into the budget. The reason it was taken out had nothing to do with the value of fairs. It had to do with the 15% mandate that the governor placed on the departments to satisfy the McCleary decision for basic education funding of K through 12. And I understand why we came out of there. I would have rather have taken the 15% hit and then tried to budget for that, but it was zeroed out. So we've got a significant challenge ahead of us, and I know you folks signed a letter to the governor. I appreciate the support. When he put his budget back out after it was submitted, there was a small increment of money for the fair fund for the what they call the youth fairs, these almost community fairs. They don't charge an admission. They don't have a significant income source. It's a way for 4-H and youth to have a project and show it, qualify to go to the state. That funding was reinstated in there, so we've got a foot in the door now. It's better than being in there with a zero. But anyway, I'll be up there all day on the 29th to argue that case, not only for Clark County, but certainly for the fairs in Washington. Yes, sir.
John, you said that you have been elected the president of the Washington State Fair Association. Congratulations. That gives you certainly a position of influence. And you said that also there's 66 annual fairs. Are they all annual in our state?
They are. The RCW that established the fair fund after they realized that the paramutual money was not going to sustain it basically recognized categories, and then fairs can qualify for a distribution from the state fair fund if they fit one of these categories. The largest and most obviously is, are you a county fair? Then they have a category called area fairs. And there are fairs in Washington where there's not a county fair. There's a fair, but it's not the county fair. And if there's two counties side by side, they can combine and they can compete for dollars from the fair fund as an area fair. And then you have what's called community fairs. And these are small, local community fairs that focus on youth and are the avenue for kids to go on toward the state fair. And then the bottom category, bottom in size, not in importance certainly, are what they call the youth fairs, and those are almost exclusively the 4-H fairs. So a small town might have the Asotin youth fair, and 4-H kids show in that, and that qualifies them to go on. Well, in recognition of that value to preserving agriculture and youth development, they qualify for the state fair fund. Now, the $2 million every year for the $4 million over the biennium is split up by the state fair commissioners travel around the state, and they grade every fair. And they look at the fairs. They grade it from everything from number of exhibits, attendance, cleanliness, friendliness. It's a very wide-ranging report card. And then that's scored, and then you're basically racked on that score, and then the percentages of the fair fund are given off based on that. And
Bragg.
Yeah, Bragg.
We've been the number one fair for 8 years.
Really?
Yes.
Number
in
one.
A row. The ironic thing.
Valedictorian here.
And I'm proud of that. I'm proud of my people. I'm proud of what we do here. We don't do that alone, obviously. It's everybody in this room. It's everybody in this county. But that's how that fair fund is distributed. And there's a need element to it. It's a pretty detailed application that you put in for the fair fund every year. And in there, all the financials are there, and we send our financials downtown, and the auditors certify that. The auditor has to sign my application, say, yes, that is his revenue, that's his expenses, that's how we perform. But then the report also has, well, how many 4-H kids participate, how many youth, how many adults, how much education do you do, what do you do for demonstrations, how clean is the place, and that one ingredient, the state fair commissioner comes around and spends 2 days with us and kind of incognito looks at us and gives us a report card. So
it used to be an annual inspection, now it's every other year?
Right. When the fair fund started to have pressure in 2010 on competing with other budget needs, one of the things the Agriculture Department did was they throttled back and said, you'll get a visit every other year, and in the interim year, you'll live on that past score. Well, when you get the top score in the state, you're liking that system really well, because next year you're going to have the same number again. So it's a good system. But yeah, that's how that works with those 66 fairs.
I had a couple questions. I don't know if this is on or not. Can you hear me okay?
I sure can.
Okay, great. So I'm sorry to be a number cruncher. First of all, congratulations on a wonderful fair. Best grade for how many years? 8 years. That's a hard act to follow, but it looks to me like you're right on the path. So I love the fair, and so I'm a big fan. I'm looking at the revenues and comparisons. If we could go back to that, it's on page 3.
Sure.
So if you could talk to us about two things. One is I see the attendance is up 1.3%, but our admissions revenue is down 0.01%. And it's hard for me to figure out what the nexus is there on that. And then the other issue I'd appreciate a few words on is parking revenue. That's off a little bit, and what I'm wondering about is capacity. Is there adequate capacity for demand? Part of the reason that revenue is off, no doubt, solves a different problem we have, which is congestion in the intersections, and that is the rate that CTRAN has for buses that go out to the fair, so you can park in any safe place in a transit center, well, in certain transit centers, and catch a bus and go out to the fair and back for $2. So CTRAN providing that service is wonderful because it helps reduce the congestion and all the rest of that. That does have an impact on fare revenue. So maybe you can just talk about those
sure.
two aspects.
In the parking one, year-round, if you go out there today, there's 7,200 parking spots. When I put the fare together, I'm down to about 5,100, the carnival being the most obvious consumer of parking spots. So I have a 5,200 car capacity out there. Every event has a formula you can use. There are some events you say, well, you better plan on 2.8 people per car. You know, concerts have a number, shows have a number, fairs have a number. And so it doesn't take you long to say, well, now, if you're running 270,000 people at an average of 27,000 a day, that's in 5,000 cars, that's 5 people per car. Or it's 2.5 people per car if you roll your population once. And we do roll the population pretty well. But on the last few days of the fair, we are extremely parking limited. So one of the things we looked at with Matt with the marketing is, what can we strike a deal with CTRAN? And you and I worked on this CTRAN thing at length.
I've been waiting for some questions on that.
Yes. And what we came up with was I was willing to give a dollar off of the gate price if you rode a bus to the fair. You get off of the bus, and they're going to give you effectively what would be a transfer. And it's got today's date on it. You walk up to the gate, and you buy your ticket. Well, it's a $10 ticket. If you have the transfer now, it's a $9 ticket. So you might not have taken advantage of the advance price in the advance market, but now you've got a dollar off. And my CTRAN ridership went up. But did that? Yes, that did take the $6 a car down. But that's why those two did that. But I did it from the standpoint of I need to get more people on these grounds. If you came out there on the last Sunday to see Monster Trucks and you wanted to catch the 2 o'clock show, you probably ought to come out and have breakfast. Because by about 1 o'clock, you're going to be somewhere out on 179th Street waiting to get in that parking lot. That bus comes up to the blue gate, which is kind of the front door, if you will. You're out within 100 feet. You're inside the fair. You didn't walk from a J-lot parking way up by the RC airplane runway, things like that. So that's sort of how that balance works. I made that offer of a dollar. It increased the CTRAN ridership, and then it relieved some pressures in my parking lot. As far as the paid admission, the attendance up. Attendance is made up of a lot of things. It's made up of paid people. It's made up of me going in and out the gate. You know, we count people. But the paid admission here, that is actually gate revenue. So, as I mentioned, that will fluctuate with people's willingness to be in or out of the advanced market. You bet.
And regarding CCHAM, it's been like 2 years since you and I talked about this. Refresh me. I thought that back when CTRAN was a significant contributor to the riders or to the attenders of the fair, that was a free service, and there were around 30,000 people that rode that. And then they started charging, and it fell down to some... a significant fall.
Significant. Yes, that was a free service. Excuse me. They approached me a few years back about the inability to maintain that, and they went to a 50-cent fare. Fare as in F-A-R-E. And we were able at that point to... You saw a drop, as you always will. It went to a dollar. When it went to $2, it took its big dip. They tried... They called and asked, what does it cost to park at the fair? And the answer was $6. So they instituted a fare that was $6 per family, and you get both ways. Well, they did that for 1 year because they would pull up to a bus stop, and there'd be 50 people standing there, and they've been waiting for that bus long enough to all agree we're in the same family. So, first person gets on, here's my $6 for my family, and on comes 50 people. So that fell by the wayside, and they went back to, all right, $2, but both ways. So if you have somebody drop you off at the fair, and it's time to go home, and they don't want to come back and fight the crowd of picking you up, you go out and get on the CTRAN bus, and you go home for free. They don't even ask for fare or for, do you have a ticket showing you rode out here? That improved things. It actually turned the corner and headed back up again. But it is, as Councilor Stewart said, it is a $2 fare both ways. But the $2 gets you there. You could get back for free if you were already on the fairgrounds. But the single thing I think that affected the ridership the most was when they tried to balance their ability to do that with the cost of it and instituted a fare system. And we talk about it every year. How do we keep it advantageous to the family, not only in terms of convenience, but in it's cheaper than driving out and spending the $6.
Sure. Because we sit on the CTRAN board, we're tuned in to the financial conditions of CTRAN.
I was on the CTRAN board when the bus to the fair was free, and the reason for a charge was not just financial. It became a legal issue because we had other entities coming to CTRAN and saying, we're having this event over here. You do it for the fair. You should do it for us for free, too. And then that, you know, so it was a matter of a legal challenge on equity. And then some people that ran the private entity that ran the event center wanted the same value. So it was determined that there would have to be a fee and that we'd have to determine if it's a public benefit or a private benefit and so on and so forth. It got to be kind of a complicated deal.
I love to take the what can be made complicated with the attorneys argue for their self-interest and simplify it. And just like a runner who's used to running a race with no hurdles, there are racers who specialize in jumping hurdles. And that may be a hurdle that I'm thinking, we should not give up because somehow the attorneys didn't get it right the first time. I'm very interested in the possibility of relieving congestion and increasing safety and increasing the attendance and really the benefit to this to the community, of our community fair, of our county fair, making the all of those that participate, and the vendors and the 4-H and all of them, have more people to be able to enjoy that and make it much more worthwhile. I'm certain this really has to do with, is there some possible way for a policy to be set that would say, with these categories defined as legally defensible, is there a way that somehow we could do that? So I'm very curious. I'll add that to one of my little curiosity projects here to see what we can do in order to increase the attendance of the fair, to get a public transit working for our community better in this area. And because I know financially, absolutely C-Tran can afford that. C-Tran, their new budget is, they got $10 million excess after they spend everything that they're planning on spending everything in the future. It's not because they can't afford it. It really has to do with setting priorities. What's the point? Are we trying to move people? Are we trying to make it more convenient so that our community can somehow get more, everybody can benefit?
I've heard that same. I don't remember what it was when they were, if they even still are running it for the 4th of July event. Do they still run the buses for that? Whether that's free. That used to happen. I don't know if that does anymore or not. I have found them to be very willing to work with us, but with this reality of there's a cost.
Always got them, their hand out for more money.
My explanation about that was not intended effort in the direction of, on the C-Tram bus and pay your money, you'd get some kind of a ticket and you could get a discount at the window when you're paying. I think that, off the top of my head, that sounds like it could be feasible and valuable for the fair. And to go back to your point, to me, the continuation of the fair, getting attendance at the fair, that's all important. But to me, one of the key features here is clearing that freeway and clearing those on and off ramps for public safety. It's an international freeway, and we want people to come to the fair. We want them to get there safely, and anything we can do in that direction is a public safety issue.
During my busiest times, I have people at the Second Avenue gate, which is about halfway between the West Precinct Sheriff's Department and the I-5 interchange. And if the traffic backs up out the fair to the Second Avenue gate, I'm within minutes of impacting the I-5 interchange. So literally what I do is stop taking money at parking. That is the single thing. Every car, unless you've got your little tag, has to stop. Oh, how much is this? It goes back and forth. We 1 year tried credit cards in the parking, and it was an absolute disaster. It took too long. And so we've gone back to parking as a cash-only operation. But as soon as I back that far up, then I just stop taking tickets. They're just free-flowing in there to stop it from backing up onto I-5 because it's dangerous. It is.
Yeah, Councillor Stewart, I might add that the gentleman to your right, Heath and Matt and Tom, they have a project on the books, several actually, for 10th Avenue to create circulation west of I-5 that potentially could be another way to stack traffic getting into the fair.
Right. And I just want to say thank you for letting us know what the excuse was or what the reason was. And absolutely, I translate your information. You never discourage innovation. You never discourage problem solving. And so you're always helpful in that, so it's positive.
Taking it in that spirit, I appreciate that.
Absolutely. I think, rather than pursue that particular topic further, I want to be able to talk with you one-on-one afterwards in order to find out what alternatives can we take. If C-Tran somehow is diminished from their capabilities of the past, maybe there's an alternative there. Maybe we can, for the fair, if you instead of having to waive the parking fees because the traffic is so bad out there, maybe we can sign up an alternative to C-Tran, particularly for that fair, so that you end up having it pencil out or something. Or maybe we can make CTRAN more successful. In any case, I'm interested in making, in solving that problem so every, so our community can be much more successful.
I get on your calendar.
Thanks.
Questions from the counselors?
I'm curious, is there the mission statement, is that clearly defined and posted somewhere so that we know what's the point?
Oh, there's two mission statements out there. There's a mission statement for the fair, which is posted all over the fair. There's a mission statement for the event center itself, which is posted in the event center, the exhibit hall. So yes, it's clearly defined and clearly posted. It may not be on the website. I can certainly put that on the website. Good point.
That'd be good. I would think that being the number one fair in the state for 8 years, that's a selling point. I assume you're marketing that. Well done. Thank you very, very much.
Okay,
thank
so
you.
You'll hang around for that conversation.
Did you want to have that conversation right after this meeting? Or do you want me to schedule
I don't have any reason not to. So if you're available, I'd be very happy to. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, John. Councilors, the second item on the agenda is the 2015 Public Works Bid Award Schedule. We've never actually shared the bid award schedule with the board before. Typically what we do is in December the board will approve the annual construction program for the following year, and then the public works folks then take that ACP, and then they have to figure out when they're going to bid which project, and there are a lot of variables involved. But this is a complex thing, and I thought it would be useful for you to get a look at it before they actually start soliciting bids on various projects. Yeah, I hear it.
Typically, that's one of these microphones. If we can pause for a minute and find out one at a time which one, wiggle the cable on each one and see if it's somehow. I think that might have been it.
I just turned mine off. I'm sorry.
It knows your life. Great. It sounds like you found it.
We do have an upgrade to the sound system in the works.
Well, as long as you got cables, that sounds like I would identify that one or that microphone. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. I've made introductory remarks, and I'll just turn it over to Heath.
Okay. Good morning, counselors. With me, I wanted to introduce, you talked about people who specialize in jumping the hurdles. You know, that's these guys here and their groups. Matt Hall is our project management manager, and Tom Grange is our engineering and construction division manager. And just by way of reference, the engineering and construction division is one of Public Works' seven divisions, and it's the group responsible for delivering all of our capital projects. And within that group, we have five different sections, of which project management is kind of the hub of that group, because we have a project manager on each one of our projects that helps basically usher and shepherd the project through the various processes that we have to go through. So, and I would say, you know, Mark and I talked about this a little bit yesterday, and he looked at this and he said, hey, this looks like a Rubik's Cube. And so I did bring toys with me, because to some extent, this is very much like a challenging puzzle that we put together every year. And what you're seeing here is really you recently adopted a subset or adopted the annual construction program, which lays out all the design work and construction work and right-of-way that we're going to purchase in 2015. And what this represents is a subset of that and the projects that are planned to go to construction. So in what this does, this is primarily an internal document that we started with, and it was really a tool for us to kind of get all our ducks in a row and schedule things appropriately, particularly as the number of projects we started building increased. And it's turned out to be a communication tool internally, so everybody knows who's on the project team, what the project, simple things like what's the work order number for the project if they have to spend some time on it, down to the type of funding and type of contract. And what we found over time is this has become valuable to many others, not just us. In particular, we meet roughly quarterly with the contracting community. So the contractors that typically bid on our work, we get together and just talk about issues and how we can do things more efficiently to help them and vice versa. And one of the things they appreciate is knowing what's coming up. I mean, just like we like to plan for the future, they do too. And so they can look at certain projects and decide, hey, this is one we're really interested in, and they're going to spend more time looking at that. Ultimately, we tend to see better pricing for the taxpayer in those situations. Other agencies use them. A lot of our work includes coordinating with utilities, natural gas, water, sewer, whatever might be out there. And sometimes they will have capital projects that they will actually include in our programs. The purchasing office helps us out a lot, so this provides them with a preview of what's coming down the road, and then we also, other departments use this as well because we do provide services for other groups. So there's quite a bit that goes into how this is put together, and one of the big things is just kind of, you know, what are the variables we consider when looking at this, and it's really, there's funding constraints, so whether there's grant timelines, we might have a timeline that's coming up that's going to expire. We need to make sure we get the project out so we don't forfeit any funding. The construction season, you know, in here in the Northwest, we are blessed with a very short construction season. So it's, you know, from April, we typically try to, construction we figure can happen generally between April and October. The reality is a lot of our work happens in the summer months, you know, June, July, August, September. So we have a significant peak in workload during the summer months. Not only do we have that, but it spills over to the contracting community too, so they're overwhelmed with work in the summer.
That's probably your quote of the day. Here in the Northwest, we are blessed with a very short construction season. You are such an optimist, and that thankfulness is coming through.
Yes. We try to make it work. And with that as well, we have, you know, we also have several endangered species and fish in particular. So we, with that short construction season, there's also a short, what we call is a fish window. So when we can actually work and stream. So those projects that are dependent on any work that happens within the water, we have to be very careful about making sure that project gets out to bid in time for that work to happen in the river. So, you know, we'll go through some of these projects in a minute, but as an example, recently we talked about the Fifth Plain Bridge project, which is planned to go this year. Well, Fifth Plain Creek is governed by a fish window, so it's very important for us to ensure that we plan everything so that project is bid in time, that a contractor can get geared up and get in there and do the work that needs to be done within the stream before the fish window closes. Typically, it's middle to end of September. So you can see what can happen if you don't meet that date. You miss a whole year, and that's when we start getting sideways with our funding agencies like the federal funds. This is the one on 88. This, we know exactly where this one is. So yeah. And then there's some work that can occur any time of the year, and we typically look for, you know, a lot of times that's things that are concrete type work, signal work, things like that. So those are the kind of things you might see those going more in the wintertime. We try to pull that work out of the summer so the work can be focused more on the other activities. Then we also have, sometimes there's economies of scales on bundling projects. So I think you're familiar, in the past we've bundled parks projects. So it's a similar type of work. You can get one contractor working on two or three parks and you'll get economies of scale and there's savings there. Same things with sidewalks and other similar projects. The other thing we kind of discussed a little bit is just contractor availability. You know, the reality is there was a time, you know, we met regularly during the recession and contractors were just hungry for anything that would come up. Well, they're getting really busy now. There's a lot of work going on, so we want to get out in front of some of that in the year so they can focus on county projects.
As of the time it's taking the state and some of these federal agencies, especially the environmental plans, how significant is that in your timetable?
Yes, and actually that's exactly what I was going to get to next, is talk about that a little bit, because that is probably one of the most challenging, and we can jump right into that, but one of the most challenging things we deal with right now is timing of the environmental permitting approvals on projects, particularly those, because usually the ones that are in stream kind of work, bridges, culverts, those are the ones that we have to time most critically to ensure we acquire the permits in time to meet the construction season. And what we've been finding is the system is fairly unpredictable. We don't have a lot of control over the reviews that happen at the state and federal agencies once the projects leave Clark County. You know, we work with them and do our best to try to gather information and predict what they're going to want. But it's not uncommon for, you know, how long are we waiting for a biological assessment?
Up to 16 months.
Yeah.
Aren't we already paying WSDOT expedite charges in order to help them move things along? Is that? Okay. And that, if you can get into the microphone for the recorder.
There's been times where they've had funding issues with that, as well as being able to keep people on to do that. So they have their challenges with budget as well. But
that's a project by project basis. That's not just simply general. Okay.
Franklin, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I know historically we have found that having WSDOT as the liaison through that process is beneficial, because we don't necessarily have the same level of support. There's two paths. So either you have federal funding or you had to have what we call a federal nexus, because you're impacting a federal wetland. And so if you go the federal wetland side, we don't necessarily have the support of a liaison in there kind of helping us and monitoring where our project is in the system. So we'd much prefer to go the other way when we can, I think. Yeah.
Federal wetland, we have a lot of that. I mean, I should know, but I would think it's a little surprising, I think, if you just, Joe Citizen, come in and say, well, federal wetland in Clark County, where is that? Maybe the Columbia River or something, but that's pretty been defined in many places, right?
Yeah, there's federal jurisdictional wetlands all over the county. So through the Corps of Engineers. So they will make determinations that it's a jurisdictional wetland from a federal perspective. It's basically all administered through the Clean Water Act. Yeah. There's three, if we impact a wetland, there could be up to three different agencies we have to satisfy, maybe there's more, but that we have to satisfy for that impact and that, depending on how the jurisdiction works out, but it will be, you know, the county has their wetland ordinance, which we work very well with our internal county staff. Then the Corps of Engineers will claim jurisdiction of that wetland, so that's the federal side. And then Department of Ecology will also claim jurisdiction on their side. So oftentimes what will happen is typically the way the process works is that the Corps will do the first review and Department of Ecology is just waiting, hey, what's the Corps going to say? And then they'll tell us whether they agree with that or not. So that loop is, you can quickly get lost in that loop. So that's really one of the big challenges. I don't know if you have anything to add to that. Or,
no, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one of
by the time I left, some progress is being made in this direction, and I think it's something we need to stay on top of and be able to influence. And that was this, that the feds would look at the different jurisdictions, their oversight, and their requirements. And if, for example, the state or the county requirements met or exceeded the federal requirements, that you could skip, that the feds would accept, which would then keep it more out of state hands, so that whatever jurisdiction had the strictest environmental standards that also met the federal standards would be accepted. And that's the kind of stuff that we can continue to work on at all levels, both in the state, because three processes for approval, and there are some examples. Clark County might be a little bit smaller, but in the state of California, projects had been held up for 5 years waiting for all those levels of approval. And by the end of 5 years, you almost have to start over again. So there is an understanding at all levels how complicated this is. And these are influences that we can continue to work on.
So you being the customer of the victim of all of this, these layers of bureaucracy, you don't have a voice in changing that, but you're being very successful in doing everything that you can to navigate through that real world out there the way it exists.
Yeah, we use staff that are in environmental services and their environmental permitting group down there, and they're extremely good at working with these agencies, and one thing is we try very hard to keep very good relationships with them and build trust, because we want them to trust what we're doing. We've always expressed that we're not going to argue about the requirements and what they are. We're happy to comply. I think our biggest need, and probably I think from anybody's perspective that's building a development in the county or any place else who may be subject to the same thing, is predictability in the timing. You know, it seems, you know, I think our perspective is 16 months to wait for an approval is unreasonable. And that is delaying progress in the implementation of infrastructure. You know, we have, as a county, we have timelines on our approvals, and we work hard to stick to those. But the accountability side on the state and federal, we're not aware that it exists at all. And so we can, you know, you may get lucky and get something approved in 45 days, and you jump for joy if and when that happens, but the likelihood is that it's going to be many months later. You know, so when we're scheduling projects like 10th Avenue, very complicated project, new road, lots of new impact, we're doing everything we can to minimize that impact, but we've got to go to those same agencies, and they're going to all spend a lot of time looking at that project, and that's why but when we say, hey, we think we can deliver it then, the reality is we're hedging our bets a little bit, because we don't really know. Because as soon as it leaves here, we can do everything that we can possibly do in our power to get it to where we think it's a reasonable project, meet our own timelines, and send it away and twiddle our thumbs for 24 months. And so that's kind of the system that we're in, and we've learned to live with it, you know, and I think we plan in our schedule our projects around that, so they all include that time frame. So what you see here is a list of projects, and that a lot of these started years ago, and we planned them to hit these milestones along the way. So in a lot of the big projects, for, you know, 119th Street that's underway right now, we started that in 2003.
So.
Mm-hmm. With regard to that, I think these projects here, they have, you know, our transportation improvement program. We have a long list of projects, and years ago, and one thing we've talked about doing is many years ago we had what we call the Transportation Improvement Program Involvement Team. We call them a TIPIT, and they helped us set the criteria and how projects are rated. And we've adjusted that a little bit over the years to include, you know, more board focuses, economic development, and things like that. And so that those projects, some of them have moved up, and really you look at the top priorities, and they are the ones where, you know, 10th Avenue, 119th Street, the ones that are high priority projects. And then we have the bigger projects are underneath that, and we work on them as we're able to get funding. Yeah, yeah. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I know that we have folks that sit on the technical staff that sit on the RTAC that help review the criteria. And we can certainly check in with them and see how are the projects ranked. I know we try to model some of it with our TIP program, in that it's intended to be as objective as possible. You know, added lanes, existing lanes, things like that. But it's probably those subjective areas that you kind of want to look at and see. Yes. Yeah. 10th Avenue's, you know, I think brief update on 2017.
Yeah. For 10th Avenue, one thing, we're still waiting a little bit on a call from WashDOT on whether we'd have to do an environmental assessment or just do our normal documented environmental process. So we're hoping to know that in February, and that's a process that could up that schedule by about 9 months. So hopefully we'll know that next month.
To address your mentioning the little projects, the right turn lanes, right turn lane here, we have a host of ongoing programs that get approved with the TIP and So when we have things that come up like that, you know, there's things we're looking at doing, trying to do some minor improvements out by the Yakult Mountain. You know, where can we make some minor adjustments there to address some concerns? And we have ongoing programs where there's budget available to make those changes. So actually one of the requests there is a right turn lane from Lucia Falls, Kelly Road to Lucia Falls. And we're looking at it, and we always have to balance the technical side of it. Is this a really warranted improvement? Is there any other considerations? You know, just as an example, one of the considerations there is, one of the concerns is the truck's going so fast. If you give them a nice, smooth right turn lane, they're not going to slow down, you know. And so, you know, we're trying to work through that and think about, is that really a good solution here? And so we can address those concerns. And as they come up, you know, we have the survey issue out there with the citizen that we're working through, and we hit them as they come.
Just a bit of feedback there. You're doing a great job. I'm a huge fan of Public Works in the way that you're building infrastructure, and the if there be any major problem, it's in those external agencies trying to get them to approve, get those through there. And in one of the symptoms of that, one of the results of that, is a large cash balance that's sitting in our road fund, tens of millions of dollars waiting for these to come through. And I think of this as kind of a, you've got all the, as a to-do list. You've got two different categories. I break my to-do list into. One is, how important is it? Well, it's got to be up there, and you got to make sure that these major projects, that you have to put it into the pipeline, that they get on the list, you do the work to be able to get it in the pipeline. The other is, how quick and easy is it? And so I guess the kind of solution and potential way that we can support you as policymakers would be to encourage those quick and easy local, smaller projects that maybe you can get a whole lot more of those done that would be more noticeable for our citizens, more significant benefit for the citizens, maybe more sidewalks, maybe more, you get a whole bunch of those done compared to some of these major ones. And I understand the risk there is that, okay, when you finally get this big project in, well, you've spent it all on these little ones. Well, if I was to risk which way to go, I would say err on which way to go. It'd be erring on taking care of too many small projects. That would, because if you don't have to put it through that long pipeline, then we'll get more done.
Yeah, and we actually often joke in our group about the easy ones have been done, you know, and that's the and that's more the easy, bigger projects. You know, the days when we built out in the Orchards area where you've got nice gravelly soil and stormwater is not an issue. And but the other pieces, you know, that's one thing we have been focusing on is some of the lower hanging fruit and, you know, the sidewalk program and actually increasing the amount of sidewalks that we implement in key areas. And so we're working on trying to do an inventory and prioritize our sidewalk system and where do we need to start focusing our efforts there. So we are doing that, and it's a balance, you know, it's a balancing act between delivering some of the high priority projects and what we have available for funding and then hitting all these smaller efforts. So trying to do it all at once to some extent. And I know we're running out of time, but I wanted to try to hit a couple quick projects and just give you on this sheet here. So these projects are basically, it's a preview for you of bids that we'll be having over the next year. Just a quick glance, the green projects that are highlighted in green, we feel pretty good about those. The timing's okay. The actual day of the bid may shift a week or two here and there, but we're fairly confident. The yellow highlighted ones are projects where we have some ongoing issues that we're working through. We think we're going to be able to work through them. The red ones we only have two of them, are ones that we have some fairly serious concerns about. And one of those that you'll see is a Brush Prairie Bridge. And I know this will be new for you, Councillor Stewart, but we've had discussions on this one before. This is the bridge maintenance project out there in the floodplain on Salmon Creek, where I have a family that's concerned about the flooding there. And we're planning to have an additional meeting with you here in the coming weeks to talk about that a little bit more. But that's one we're already a year behind.
From Vice Family?
I haven't knew it.
The thought was is maybe we could chat before we answer. And yeah. The Harding Farms project, the other red one, that is a clean water project, which is actually contingent on some state funding that's coming through the legislature, as I understand it. We're kind of showing it here as a placeholder, but it may move to 2016, depending on when those funds become available. And the key dates probably for you are highlighted kind of in the orange areas when we come to you for some approvals to move forward. And so you can see, overall, we have 26 projects planned to go to bid this year. That is up significantly from years past. We used to be mainly transportation. You know, we did roads, bridges, sidewalks. Now we do parks, stormwater facilities. We're doing a project for Heritage Farm this year. So we've kind of broadened the type of work we do, who we serve, and now we're well over 20 projects every year.
These are great projects. I mean, they're significant. I look at the advancements and the ability to build new infrastructure here in this county. I wonder how other counties are doing in comparison. This is a lot of new, great infrastructure.
What you see here, just in construction only, is almost $39 million. And, you know, if you add another, say, 30% to that for right-of-way and design, that's a significant investment in the community.
There's two bids mainly. One is the design and engineering, and the other is the construction. Do I understand that correct?
There's really only one bid, or formal competitive bid, which is the actual bid of the construction work. Sometimes we'll have, depending on what our resources are internally, we'll go through a request for proposal process where we'll, by qualifications, we'll review different consultants and ask them to help us out.
So by the time it hits this schedule, all of that permitting process, we're assuming and hoping that these agencies are going to get this returned to us in time to actually make that happen. And do we wait until we actually receive that approval to actually go to bid? Or is there some anticipation you have the freedom to say, we think it's going to happen, you can get the bid in there, but don't start work till you actually get the paper?
We've wrestled with this question, frankly, quite a bit on how much to push the envelope. There may have been one or two cases historically where we have bid and said, we'll bid it, but you can't go to work until we have this permit. But we found it's just not a good idea. Because oftentimes we don't really know exactly what that permit's going to say till the last minute when it comes in, and it may have a mitigation requirement that we didn't expect. And then if we go out early, we bid a project and we already have a change order for a change condition. So we try to play nice as much as we can.
Those that normally bid in these kind of projects, the transparency is there. They can kind of see what's coming, and they can do any interest kind of homework, curiosity, kind of get their resources ready to go, but they can't actually bid on it until you get that permit.
Our plans, we have different distribution of plans. We have 30, 50, 90, and final plans, percent plans that we put out. And we put those out on an FTP site through our website, so any contractor can go there and pull down different levels of plans. In some cases where we've had a really difficult project, just construction challenges, we've had a little, Tom organized a meeting a couple of years ago on 88th Street where we needed some contractor input on how would you build this section of the road. It's really challenging. Just part of it so they can see what's kind of coming, part of it's to get some feedback from the contracting community. You know, what's a better way to design this? We don't have a good feel for how you would build it. And so we try to get a little bit of interaction with the group. Unless you have any other questions, I know we've taken up a lot of your time. Anything you wanted to add, anybody?
Thanks for doing a great job and doing everything you can to move this county ahead.
A lot of moving parts. We just wanted the board to have an appreciation for just how complex their work is.
So, you know, they've got the Rubik's Cube here, you know, all different colors. You know, eventually we get it to where maybe it looks like, you know, kind of like that.
I thought you were going to complete it.
Try to get about 80% there. So.
Which is the smart way to go.
My son can do it. I kind of cheated and just.
For those that can't see here in the audio, we just watched.
Yeah, I need to introduce your son to my grandson because he's got one and he hadn't figured it out yet.
So you completed it. So you get full.
My son
full credit
completed
there.
It. I can't take credit.
Thank you for really excellent work. And what I would
like to talk about.
Tom had a
Oh, well, he's gone. So before I bring it up, I want to talk to him about it. But something he brought up, I see an opportunity for a better integrated understanding of all this for the commissioners. And I think you would likely be the person that would be able to provide us. And that is how all this work is integrated. From inception, and then in the broader, which of it gets to RTC, the prioritizing through RTC, the potential for us to have greater influence about that, if there is any, on key projects, and to maybe just have a little work session with the commissioners where you can help us. You are very excellent at looking at the broad and then filling in details as much as are necessary for kind of a snapshot would be helpful. So, but I'll talk to Tom about what he'd like to see, and then we'll talk to Mr. McCauley and, of course, you, of course. So thank you very much.
Okay, with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you very much.